Welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperon. I'm really happy to be here as your host for this program, talking about health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. We have a very special guest, the author of Secret Medicines from Your Garden, Plants for Healing, Spirituality, and Magic, Ellen Everett Hopman. And Ellen weaves together ancient wisdom, mystical folklore, and modern plant research. She's a master herbalist, and she explores the use of, in this book, flowers, trees, weeds, and ornamental plants for food medicine, spiritual growth, and even magical rituals. She reveals the herbal laws surrounding each plant, drawing on traditional knowledge and remedies from around the world, including Native American, Celtic, which she's a specialist in, and even Egyptian traditions. She even includes recipes throughout the book, so you can take the medicines from the wild and domestic plants and make them into foods and medicine and enjoy them all year round. So without further ado, we're going to bring on Ellen Everett Hopman. Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And your book deserves such an interesting book. I love that you have not only published that, but many, many books in the herbal genre. Tell us about some of your other books and eventually what led you to write this book.
Well, there are a lot. I think there's 13 at this point altogether.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the first book that I wrote is out of print now. It's called Tree Medicine, Tree Magic. I did follow up with a new tree book called A Druid's Herbal of Sacred Tree Medicine. And I wrote that first book just because I moved to New England, and where I live in the woods, and there's actually more trees here than there were when the first European settlers got here. There's not much light around the house, and I couldn't figure out how people survived up here. I'm on top of a mountain in the woods, and I thought, how did people do it when the growing season is so short and there's not much light? And then it finally dawned on me that they must have been eating the trees and using them for other things. So I went looking for a book, and this was in the 80s, that would show me how to do that, and couldn't find one. And so I said, gee, I guess I have to write it myself.
Right.
And I was in graduate school at the time, I was studying counseling, but I just had this idea, well, I guess I got to write this book. And I've been doing that ever since. So that was the first one. And if you look up A Druid's Herbal of Sacred Tree Medicine, you will learn it's all based on ancient Celtic material, herbal uses, and spirituality. There's another one called The Druid's Herbal for the Sacred Earth Year, which takes you through the Wheel of the Year and tells you which plants, herbs mostly, are appropriate for rituals like hand fasting, baby blessing, house blessing, weddings, whatever, things like that, funerals. What else is there? Oh, there's Walking the World in Wonder, a children's herbal, which homeschoolers love.
Really?
Yeah,
that's nice.
Have you ever seen it? It's a big
favorite. No, that one I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, well, it has 75 different projects that parents and teachers can do with kids. And it has beautiful photographs from Stephen Foster. He did a really nice job, so you can identify the plants and some of the projects are herbal, some of them are artistic, like making collages, things like that with plants. And each plant has a smiley face if you can eat it. It has a frowny face if you can't eat it,
Wow. Mr. Yuck.
Then there's a bunch of novels as well, of course, which have... I have a Druid trilogy which has a lot of herbal information. It takes place in the Iron Age in Ireland and Scotland. So I have a lot of medicine in there about plants they would have used. And all those plants grow in New England, by the way, so they're not that exotic. really.
Now, I learned a lot of herbal medicine by reading, you know, Clan of the Cave Bear and things
like
that,
that's,
too.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a very accurate book. I was surprised.
Yeah.
She did a good job with that book.
So,
you could read Priestess of the Forest and the Druid Isle and Priestess of the Fire Temple, and you could actually learn which plants they were using and how they were using them in the Iron Age.
Now, I know you never really set out to be an herbalist. You were studying, was it art history or something like that you were telling me?
Yeah, I started out as an art history major, and then I ended up getting a degree, a master's in counseling eventually. But, yes, I have a whole chapter in the new book, Secret Medicines from Your Garden, where I talk about how that happened.
Yeah.
But basically, I was in Philadelphia at Temple University, and I was getting my master's in art history, and I was also a TA, a teaching assistant at the graduate level, and I was a straight-A student, and one day they just said, you're going to Rome, and they gave me a scholarship. I never even applied for it, and I said, I don't want to go to Rome. I want to study early American photography. And they said, nope, you're going to Rome. You're going to study Renaissance art. And I was like, okay. So off I went, and I was there for 6 months. But I started out doing research at the Herziana Library and various libraries around Rome. And then I decided to go to Assisi one day, which is, where St. Francis lived. And I wanted to see the frescoes by Giotto that were in the cathedral there. So I went to the cathedral, and I saw these gorgeous frescoes all along the ceiling, and they had a lot of gold leaf. And I thought, that doesn't seem right, because I knew enough about St. Francis to know that he was a very simple monk. You know, he wasn't really into gold. That wasn't his thing. So I walked up to this little priest, and I said, how can I find out more about St. Francis, about how he really lived and who he really was? And the priest said, go to San Maceo. And I said, what is San Maceo? And he said, don't ask any questions, just go. So the whole thing was basically I was on a shamanic journey from the beginning, you know. I just was following orders, and off I went down the road. And there was this little wooden sign pointing off to the right that said San Maceo. It was handwritten, hand-painted. And I went down this muddy little path and came into this clearing. And there were all these students lying around, mostly German students. And they looked at me and they said, oh, have you come here to live? And I said, I don't know. What is this place? And it was a Franciscan community. And it was the real deal. It was medieval buildings. The buildings were sheep folds. That's what they had previously been. But now one building was for the women, one was for the men. And it was straw mattresses and cold water, no hot water. There was a central building. Bread was baked in a stone oven. Chickens and ducks were allowed to wander around at will, wherever they wanted to go. So they were going in and out of the buildings. And I stayed there for a few days, went back to Rome, packed up all my stuff, went back to Assisi. And in the community, we had mass twice a day. And on Wednesdays, we had a day that was for wandering in the wilderness. That's how they put it. And you were supposed to fast and go off into the wilderness with no thought of where you were going. So off I went, and I climbed up this mountain called Mount Subasio, which is where St. Francis used to spend time. And I was up above the tree line, and this huge storm came, thunder and lightning and snow. And I was in the middle of it with no shelter of any kind except this one little pine tree that I wrapped myself around, which was pretty dumb, thinking back. But that was the only other thing besides the grass up there. So when the storm blew over very quickly, and I came back down the hill soaking wet, and there was this little chapel that St. Francis had built with his own hands, which was pre-Gothic. It was Romanesque, I guess, so it was very dark in there. I went into the chapel, sat down in the dark, and all of a sudden I heard this voice, and the voice said, everything you've been doing up until now was for status and intellect. You're supposed to be working with plants.
Really?
And the voice came from inside of me and outside of me at the same time. It was this clear voice, and I went, oh, I knew it was correct. I knew it was absolutely right. So mentally, I started unloading everything I was doing, the college degree, the thesis I was working on, everything. And the more I unloaded that stuff, this energy kind of built up in my chest, which is actually a very Celtic thing. The Celts say you have a cauldron in your chest, you know, and the cauldron was activated. And from then on, I just went on to study with William Le Sorcier, and I studied at Findhorn in Scotland, and off I went.
And you were you worried about, like, making a living as an herbalist? Or, because there's a lot of listeners that would be like, well, that sounds like a really great calling. What can you do as an herbalist?
Well, I remember distinctly, well, first of all, the university was very upset with me. My parents were furious. When I started studying with William, I said to him, he said, what do you want to do with all this? I said, I want to be an herbalist. And he said, that's very tough karma. That's exactly what he said. And I never forgot that. But, I mean, what I tell my students, because I have students, and I teach a six-month course every year, October to April, in Western Massachusetts. And when my students say, I want to be an herbalist, you know, my standard remark to them is, if you really want to make a living at this, you need to get a naturopathic degree. You know, that's what I tell them. I say, get your degree. Go to MCNM, go to John Bastier, go to one of the really good naturopathic colleges, get your degree, and then you can have a comfortable living. That's what I tell them.
Interesting.
Because, you know, most herbalists we're really a bunch of renegades. You know, we're like weeds. We're like, you know, we eke out a living. It's tough. It's really, we're like very stubborn weeds. That's how I look at it.
Well, that's good advice for the next generation that are really interested in that as an herbalist. But certainly writing books and things like that is a nice way to at least take your information and give it to the next generation, which I think is a very great calling that we have, to make sure that what was passed to us is shared to the next generation.
For the future, so, absolutely,
yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, the whole culture, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but I remember back in the day when there was really nothing. There were very few books out there.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go to the library if you wanted to look something up. You know, there were no computers. There were no...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You couldn't walk into Whole Foods and punch in a condition.
There weren't.
And have
there were
the
no.
Computer
I remember Ellen trying to find the homeopathic remedy. And
oh,
it was
wow.
impossible
yeah.
to try to even find a homeopathic remedy where I was growing up in Long Island. No, yeah.
Right, right. I lived in Philadelphia where Borky and Toffel was in Philadelphia. They're out of business now. But,
right, yeah.
I mean, they've been around, or they were around since the 1800s, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Or early 1900s. But, yeah, that was all. It was really esoteric stuff, which is why in order to study herbalism, I had to get on the train two or three times a week and go to New York to study with William, you know.
Oh, is that where your teacher lived?
Of course, there was no other way to do it.
So your teacher lived in New York then?
Yeah, I was in Philadelphia. He was in New York City.
Mm.
Wild Willie, they used to call him.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was a whole different world, and people were so anxious and desperate for the knowledge. They really wanted it. And I remember I did radio shows in the 80s, they said they'd never seen anything like it. You know, every phone would light up. People wanted the information, you know, because they couldn't get it. And now it's everywhere. So it's a whole different world. It really
different.
Is.
And so, you know, one of the things I love about your book is there's many, many wonderful chapters that we'll talk about today. But I love your understanding of the doctrine of signatures, because if we go back, I mean, we're not ancient herbalists, though sometimes I feel ancient. But if you go back to antiquity, you wonder, how did early humans figure this stuff out? I mean, it just blows me away. Was it shamanic influences? Was it trial and error? Was it that you can trust a wise person because they're not dead, because they would have eaten something poisonous? I mean, when I lecture to my students at the College of Naturopathic Medicine, because I did do that route that you did, I wanted to be an herbalist, but was mm-hmm. encouraged to become a naturopathic physician, and I'm a Bastyr graduate. But
oh, good
nonetheless,
for you.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you know, the ancients somehow figured this out, and you know, I mean, you read like Shen Nong, the ancient Chinese emperor. He tasted the herbs and wrote it down, and then I'm sure the Celts, they didn't write stuff down; they passed it through stories and mythology. How did ancient people learn this stuff?
Well, all of the above, everything
yeah,
you
yeah.
just said.
Right.
Yeah, well, one way was the stories, of course. And, for example, in my book, A Druid's Herbal of Sacred Tree Medicine, I give stories for each tree in the old Irish alphabet. It was called the tree alphabet. It didn't go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, it went rowan, oak, willow. Those were the letters of the alphabet. Mm. And each of those trees has amazing stories and poetry associated with them, and that was the way to hand down the information. For example, the rowan berry, which is the mountain ash, the berries have more vitamin C than lemon, so that in the highlands of Scotland and in Ireland, they would make a syrup with honey, apple slices, and rowan berries, and if somebody had pneumonia, bronchitis, you know, any kind of a chest thing going on, which I'm sure there was a lot of with all the smoke in the fires, you know, they would make this syrup and they would give it to people. So how do you pass down this information that the rowan is important? Well, they said this. There was this man, and he went to the land of fairy, and he was there what he thought was just a day, but for the people that he left behind, it felt like 7 years. And he knew enough to know the old prohibition, which is that when you go to the land of fairy, you don't eat anything, because if you eat something from there, you'll get stuck there and you'll never come back. So what did he do? He shoved the berries. He saw these incredible berries. They were glowing. They were so beautiful. And he put them in his pocket. And when he came back from the land of fairy, he emptied his pockets and the berries fell on the ground. And that's how the first rowan tree, the first mountain ash, came to Ireland. So what does that mean? That means that you tell your children that story, and they know there's something magical about this tree. And they said everybody who ate the berries grew to be old and wise and lived a long time. In other words, the people that eat the berries live a long time. The people that don't eat the berries don't live very long. You know, so
right, yeah.
I mean, that's one way. But the other way is the doctrine of signatures, which you know, I go into great detail about that, but people couldn't read. They didn't have books. They didn't have libraries. You know, they didn't have a computer. They couldn't look anything up. So they learned that by the color of the plant, the shape of the plant, the flavor of the plant, the shape of the root, the kind of soil that it was growing in, was it in the sun, was it in the shade, they were able to classify plants that way, you know, and it would tell you, you know, by the shape, by the color, you would know, was it for the liver, was it for the kidney, was it for the reproductive organs, was it for the brain, was it for the nervous system, and that was all done without books.
Yeah.
Because very few people could read until, you know, 150 years ago.
And you know, it's so right. It's so right on. That's what blows me away about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it works beautifully.
It's like they're right more times than they're incorrect.
Right. That's right.
I'll give you an example.
You know,
like
humans are, generally, we're not that stupid. If something works, we hold on to it, you know, because we had to for survival. If something doesn't work, we're not going to hang on to it.
Mm.
So if something's been around for centuries or millennia, I always assume there must be a grain of truth in there. And I try to dig it out, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of, it's easy to even use this information for herbs that you're not familiar with. Like, you know, sometimes I travel and I'm not familiar at all with the herbs. I was asked to give a talk out west in California recently.
Exactly.
And I didn't know, you know, this was north of San Francisco, right? And I didn't really know a lot of the plants there, but I kind of looked the way they grew and what they looked like, and were they growing in the shade or sunlight, or
right.
were they growing in, well, it was mostly dry soil out there, so you figure, you know, that they're going to be valuable for helping either bring moisture to certain areas or whatnot, because they can store moisture.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know if plants live alone or in a group, you have some good information about that.
Right.
But tell us a little bit about the shapes. You know, most of us have heard of, like, ginkgo looks like a brain, but you go into it in more detail.
Well, there's a plant called hepatica, which is good for the liver, and the leaves are lobed just like a liver. That's mm-hmm. one example.
What about the lungwort? I know that's a story that I often tell my students.
The leaves of the lungwort, pulmonaria, have little white spots, and those white spots are the signature for pus sacs on the lung. So if somebody has, you know, an infected lung with pus, that's it tells you it's good for that. Caladium looks like a lung. A lot of people have caladium in their house, or you grow it outside in really shady areas. And homeopathic caladium is fabulous for people who have quit smoking and are trying to clear out their lungs. You know, but if you look at the leaf, it's shaped like a lung, and it has, you know, spots and veins like a lung that has some issues going on, you know. But it's a great remedy for lungs.
What about the pain? I do a lot of work with patients in chronic pain, whether they have arthritis or some other autoimmune disease. I know there's quite a bit of doctrine of signatures on different herbs for pain.
Well, that has to do with the veins in the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Things that have raised veins are more for circulation, and things that have prominent but not raised veins, and if they have purple flowers, tend to be more for the nervous system.
Mm-hmm. And then that would help people with, you know, the transmission of pain. And I like even your discussion of, you know, people should use their senses when they're trying to figure out what herbs do. You should smell it, maybe taste it, because doesn't Mother Nature put bitter things and sometimes things that we shouldn't have, although there's examples of bitters that are actually quite good for us, but I know some of the bitter tastes kind of connote maybe danger, or maybe we should just use this for a short period of time.
Exactly.
Or something.
I mean,
like,
if
that.
It's that bitter, if your reaction is, oh, you know, if you, like, for example, golden seal, you know, I've actually known of situations where people were prescribed by herbalists who didn't know what they were talking about, who told people to take golden seal like three or four times a day for a year for cleansing.
Wow, a year.
Which is, yes, and it totally destroyed this person's digestive tract. I mean, destroyed it, you know. If something tastes that bitter, it's telling you something. I mean, golden seal grows deep in the woods, and it's not easy to get to. It doesn't grow right around the house like dandelion, plantain, clover, all those things that grow right around the house you can use all the time. But golden seal, you have to look for it. It's deep in the woods. So when something grows that far away and is that hidden, that tells you it's for very special use for a very special time. And then you taste it, and it's incredibly bitter. So it's telling you, you know, it's not something that you take every day. I mean,
yeah,
that's
like
just another example.
Like a nutritive herb. I know that there's some herbs that you can actually use as foods. What are some herbs that people can use out of their garden pretty regularly and are kind of considered like edible pot herbs?
Well, right now, as a matter of fact, it's probably the same in where you are in New York, but right now the nettles are coming up, and this is the perfect time for nettles. Because you have to get them when they're less than 6 inches tall, and they make a wonderful sauté with a little egg, you know, sautéed with scrambled eggs. And you can also, well, the dandelions aren't up yet. The nettle is, because it's a very tough plant. But when the dandelions come up, of course, the dandelion leaves. Young, very young plantain leaves, very young maple leaves. When the maple tree first puts out the leaves and they're still red, they have like a pink blush, you can eat those. There's a lot going on right now. When the hemlock trees put out their new growth, tips of the branches, you can eat that.
Mm-hmm.
It also has more vitamin C than lemons.
Survival foods.
Yeah, or, I mean, it's medicine, too. I mean, the hemlock tips, you can freeze them and use them if you have a sore throat or a cold. Ooh. The nettles are very high in iron, so it's a great iron supplement for those that need that. They're also antihistaminic. So if somebody has allergies, any kind of inflammation like that, allergies, you can eat the nettles. You can take nettle capsules, you know, instead of taking the over-the-counter, whatever it is they give you, you know. Please take nettles, you know.
Yeah, sure. For allergies, yeah. And then I know poke root is considered it goes back to even what Paracelsus said, you know, there's no such thing as a poison, it's only the dose. So
even
the most poisonous herbs can be used medicinally, but those are kind of herbs that you really need to be an expert to mess with, I guess.
Yeah, I would be very careful with poke, but if you use homeopathic poke, of course, you're not going to have any problem with it. It's not going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. But you can poultice with the roots, add it to poultices, especially for mastitis or sore breasts. And again, the young, it has to be less than 6 inches tall. The young greens are delicious. They're wonderful. But once they get past 6 inches, they can be toxic.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that old expression, happy is the pig in the poke.
I never heard that one.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
That's a southern thing, I guess. Down south, you can actually buy canned poke leaves. But poke is really delicious when it's young. But it has to be very young, you know.
So kind of, since we're talking about spring, and that's kind of what's happening here, what are some of the herbs of spring that we can think about using, particularly as spring continues to progress? We talked about the dandelion. Now, that's an interesting plant because people spend billions of dollars trying to eradicate this plant on their lawn.
Right,
it's
which is crazy.
Bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah, that's sad because when you do that, the pesticide, it harms the bees and other, you know, insects that try to land on the plant, which means it's going to harm birds if they go to eat the insect, and it's going to leach into the groundwater. I mean, it's just crazy because we should be eating it. As soon as the leaves come up, start eating them. In fact, the French think that the dandelions are so wonderful that they grow them as a vegetable, and they'll put an upside down basket over the plant in the summer so that it doesn't get tough and green, you know, dark green, so it stays pale green. And
wow.
I mean, they're considered a delicacy. Mm. And the flowers, when the flowers come out, you can make sure you get rid of the green sepals, which are at the base of the flower. Just use the petals. And you can put the petals in salads. They're very high in calcium. You can make dandelion wine. You can put them in fritters. You can make vinegar, dandelion vinegar. I have recipes in the book.
You
I'm
do.
Sure
you do. We'll get to that. But we're going to take a quick break. At the half-hour mark here. Wow, went fast. And we're going to play a little bit of the Natural Medicine Chest and a couple ideas. And so you're listening to Progressive Radio Network. This is the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. And we're here with Ellen Everett Hopman, talking about her book, Secret Medicines from Your Garden, Plants for Healing, Spirituality, and Magic. Stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
Very good. So, we're excited to talk about nutrition and nutrients and herbs, and back with more of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and of course, Ellen Everett Hopman, Secret Medicines from Your Garden. Where can they get the book, Ellen? Like Amazon and all places like that?
Oh, yeah. It's available everywhere. I also have a website, which is Ellen Everett, that's E, V as in Victor, E-R-T, Hopman.com, EllenEverettHopman.com. If you order from me, you get a signed copy with a personal note. Otherwise, yeah, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore can get it for you at this point. So.
And Hopman is one P and one N at the end.
Right, H-O-P-M-A-N.
Although usually, you know, the computer corrects for all those things. But nonetheless, I notice my daylily is coming up. Now, I kind of don't want to really cut them. Is it the flower that's edible, Ellen, or what do we do with the daylilies?
The whole thing. You can
really
eat the whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah, daylilies need to be thinned anyway. They tend to get very packed in.
Yes.
So a really good thing to do, well, in the spring, you can eat the roots, and you can do that all year round. The roots are just like potatoes. They're like little potatoes,
wow,
except you can eat them raw or cooked. And if you're going to take anything out of the ground and eat it, make sure you soak it in water with, I'd say about a quart of water with a tablespoon of sea salt or a couple tablespoons of vinegar for 20 minutes. And what that does is it causes any little microorganisms or parasites to drop off, and then rinse it carefully. But the potatoes can be sliced and eaten in a salad. They can be, the roots, like potatoes, they can be steamed, sautéed. You know, they're delicious. The young leaves can be eaten in salad or steamed. Mm. And actually, the leaves can be eaten later in the summer as well. And then the flower buds, when they come out, they can be sautéed or steamed. Mm. And the open flowers are edible, but if you try to sauté them, they melt. They just melt away.
Yeah, right.
So what you do is that when the flowers are open, you could make fritters or you could drop them into soups. You know, the whole thing is, the only part that's not edible, as far as I'm aware, is the stem.
Right.
It's kind of tough. But.
Yeah. And now, of course, we see coming up the stellaria, or the chickweed. We usually see that on, like, you know, close to the buildings or foundations or warmer areas that have huge patches of chickweed. What are some great things we can do with chickweed?
Well, it makes a beautiful salve. In the book, I have at least one salve recipe, I'm sure. But chickweed is really nice to simmer in olive oil, and then you add beeswax, and it just makes a beautiful salve for dry skin, itchy skin, other skin conditions. I mean, I've read that it's really good for skin cancer, although I can't claim that. You know, I've never personally seen it work on that, but I hear, I hear through the grapevine that it could even be used for that. It's just good for skin conditions in general.
That's great. It makes sense. I think. I've used it for eczema with comfrey and echinacea, kind of a combination of making it into like a salve and osterizing it with a little bit of glycerin and oils and I think a little beeswax to kind of make a lotion out of it. So,
right,
yeah,
and that sounds beautiful.
Some good,
yeah.
So part four is your formula making part of the book. Boy, you have quite a bit on. Actually, this is important, folks, because this is how you can actually take the bounty out there that Mother Nature gives us and actually preserve them and make them into medicines that you can use all year round. That's actually a very important skill to do and learn about, because, you know, it's great to walk around the woods and see all the plants and have this knowledge, but then you really need to take the knowledge and make it into medicines. That's what it's all about. So you talk about things like teas and powdered herbs, how you can, I guess, just kind of make them into, just dry the herbs and pulverize them into a powder. Also using external things like we talked about, like liniments. Now, a liniment is considered like a high alcohol or vinegar preparation that you kind of rub into an area, and that's a little bit different from a plaster and fomentation and a poultice. Can you talk about the different external things that herbalists can do for patients that either whack themselves or get a case of poison ivy or get a cut or something like that in the garden? There's all kinds of topical things you can do.
Well, if you have a comfrey plant, I think everybody needs to have comfrey somewhere in the garden. That's going to be your number one wound herb, I think. What I like to do with comfrey, and this could be for anything from a surgical scar to a deep wound, but make sure the wound is very clean, because comfrey is such an amazing wound healer that if the wound is not absolutely clean, the comfrey will cause it to seal up, and then, you know, you could end up with stuff left behind. So everything has to be really, 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 really clean. But you can make a poultice. I take the fresh leaves of comfrey, and I put them in the blender with just enough water to break them down, you know, and then I put that, I pour that into a bowl, and then I take powdered slippery elm bark, and I just keep adding it a little bit at a time, and then mixing it around with my hand until I slowly get what I call a pie dough consistency.
Oh.
And I mean, when you put slippery elm in, you'll see it very quickly expands and absorbs whatever liquid is there. You get this pie dough consistency. And then you take that and you put it on a very, very, very clean cloth. Or you can get, if you want to be really professional, these they're called Chuck's bed pads.
Okay.
And you just put it on there. Then you put another cloth on top, or even plastic saran wrap kind of thing. Roll it out with a rolling pin. If you don't have a rolling pin, you can use a bottle.
Yeah.
Roll it out till it's like a pancake, and then you apply that pancake to the surgical scar or the wound. And what it is the slippery elm has vitamin C, calcium, sorry, and the comfrey is a calcium precursor. It doesn't have calcium, but it enables the body to metabolize calcium, and calcium is the great tissue healer, you know. So you combine those two, and you leave it on for an hour, and then discard. You don't reuse it, you know.
Oh, okay, okay.
But,
that's great.
In the Revolutionary
War, I broke my hand a couple of years ago, right? I was, because I'm a black belt, right?
Oh.
So I broke my hand breaking wood. I hit it the wrong way, you know. And so I was like ready to take my students to my annual trip to Jamaica, which we just got back. We just had a wonderful time in the rainforest in Jamaica.
Wow.
And so, excuse me, so I was, the orthopedist said, look, you broke your hand. I don't want to, you could do surgery, but then, you know, then you're not going to be able to use your hand. Why don't you just do your herbal stuff? I'll give you a couple weeks, and if it seems to heal pretty well and you don't need surgery, then you can kind of go on your trip. So I was like, oh, I better do something fast. So I used the comfrey, and within 3 weeks of going back to the doctors and getting an x-ray, the callus formation, you know, like when the bone starts laying down, that kind of soft kind of healing, and before it really gets calcified and tough, was already happening. And he tended to be an open-minded guy, because, you see, he was a world traveler. I find that doctors that have traveled the world and looked at how kind of indigenous people use medicine are pretty open to certain things. So he has spent time in the jungles in Indonesia and knew about poultices that were used by the local people. So he was all excited for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I was amazed how comfrey had healed me. And it's been, I always tell that story to patients that have fractured themselves or banged their shins or something like that, because it tends to heal the bone as well, I feel.
Well, the old folk name for comfrey is knit bone.
Right.
It's called knit bone because it knits bones.
Makes sense.
I mean, there's a reason why they call it that. That's another thing that you really need to pay attention to, the folk names for things. If something's called knit bone or bone set is another one. Bone set is this amazing plant that takes care of pain in the bone. And you can imagine, you know, back in the day when they had bone setters, if they set your bone, you know, you had pain in the bone. How are you going to get to pain in the bone, you know? So they would give you bone set for the pain. So you have knit bone to heal the bone and bone set to take care of the pain. Bone set, of course, is also really good for fevers. Flu, fever, things like that, because it grows in swamps. That's part of the doctrine of signatures. It grows in swampy areas, so it's good for moist conditions, you know. But, yeah, comfrey is amazing. It really is.
The local Jamaicans were talking about, and it's interesting, they were looking at a cousin to the bone set, which I think is in the Eupatorium genus, right? So they were looking at a cousin to this, and they said that this was the cure for chikungunya, which is the really bad mosquito-borne, well, I'm sure there's worse diseases that mosquitoes carry, like dengue and whatnot, but nonetheless,
yeah,
people were suffering a lot in Jamaica with the chikungunya, where after they got bit, they would have like an arthritis, arthralgia, that and muscle pain that lasted weeks and weeks and weeks. Mm. And I found it fascinating. I actually picked up, I don't know if it was a copy of your book, but it was one of the big herbal classics. And I found that the one that the Jamaicans were saying helped is a cousin to Bone Set or Joe Pieweed or the other one. I just found that fascinating that these cultures that don't talk to each other mm-hmm. figured this stuff out, Ellen.
What color are the flowers?
They're white.
Oh, okay, so that's part of the Doctrine of Signatures. Bone Set has these white flowers, which when I look at that, it's telling me, duh, it's for bones.
See?
So it has white flowers. It grows in damp areas, you know. Anyway, yeah, and comfrey
wow.
also. Some of the comfrey has purple flowers, which indicates that it's probably good for nerve pain or nerve damage. But most of the comfrey has white flowers, which tells you it's for bone, you know. But, yeah.
Now, when you're making a formula, because I know you studied with William, mm-hmm. and he was like one of the masters of making herbal formulas, is there a way that people should, like, you know, like, they learn all this stuff about herbs, but then they're trying to figure out, well, which herb should I use? There are so many different blood cleansers out there. You know, I'm thinking about the spring now, cleansing your blood. There's, like, so many of them. You can, mm-hmm. red clover and chickweed and dandelion and violet.
Milkweed.
And milkweed. They all clean out your blood, as the old saying goes. How do you choose which is the most
milk
appropriate
thistle,
one for a person?
Thistle.
Yeah. And make a formula, you know.
Yeah, well, in the book, I try to break it down, and I suggest that people read it slowly. Read it slowly, because if you try to swallow it quickly, it's not going to make sense. But you have to go very slowly and make drawings. You know, I mm-hmm. made drawings for every step of the process. And I suggest that you do that as well, that as you're reading the chapter, draw the little triangle, you know, and you'll get it. I mean, the way this happened, according to William, he said what happened was he was lying on the couch one day, and his wife was yelling at him. This was his first wife. And he was doing his best to zone her out because he didn't want to listen to what she was saying. So he kind of went off, you know, he was very mystical. And all of a sudden, Pythagoras, the mathematician Pythagoras, appeared to him.
Wow.
And started giving him this system of formula making. What's interesting to me is that Pythagoras studied with a druid named Abaris. Mm. And we don't know if Pythagoras learned his mathematics from Abaris, or if Abaris learned his mathematics from Pythagoras. All we know is they hung out together, you know, so that makes it Pythagoras very interesting for druids, and I'm a druid. So, but anyway, and druids love the number three. That's a whole other topic. But Pythagoras gave him this formula, and basically it's hard to explain verbally. You really need to go through the book.
Yeah,
but, you draw a large triangle, and then you put an inverted triangle within the large triangle. The inverted triangle is the center of gravity of the illness. So whatever you're dealing with, like if it's a lung condition, you put lung in the center. If it's a heart condition, you put heart in the center. You know, the center of gravity, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then that leaves you with three small triangles, one on top and one on each side. And those three small triangles are concomitants. So say somebody had chronic bronchitis or something. Say they also were constipated. So the colon might be one of the concomitants, you know. Say they had really dry skin. So skin might be one of the concomitants.
Yeah, okay.
What else? What would be a third thing that they would have?
Well, Maybe they have a urinary tract issue. Or
okay,
like
so you put the bladder is another
right,
one.
Right, right.
So in the center triangle, which is the center of gravity, you have three parts of a builder, three parts of a cleanser, three parts of a tonic. And every triangle has to have builder, cleanser, tonic.
Builder, cleanser, and tonic. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because the way, well, Williams' system, it's related to the Chinese formula making. It's an 18-part formula. But he always said that the minimum, unless you're in an emergency, you can take one herb because you want it to act very quickly. But the minimum number of herbs you should be taking is usually three. You want a builder, a cleanser, and a tonic because you want the herb to be building the tissue and moving out stuff simultaneously. And he said that if you take just one herb for a long time, what you're doing is you're constantly hitting the same organ the same way over and over and over again, which
so
is going to be irritating
things
to the body.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you have three parts builder, three parts cleanser, three parts tonic in the middle, which gives you nine parts. And then you fill in the other triangles. It's kind of hard to explain, verbally, but
it's well written out in this chapter, and there's been different variations on Williams' triangle system, but it's a great way to think about making a formula there, you have, and I think you're right, it's based on the Chinese concept that you have a chief herb and deputies and drivers and things that kind of connect the formula and things that make it go through all the meridians and things like that. So it's a nice way to attempt this very, take this complex thing and make it, I wouldn't say simple, but, certainly something more user-friendly for folks that they could think about, making a formula there. So,
it's
formula.
Really good for constitutional prescribing. If you're going to be taking a formula for, say, 3 months would be the minimum, 3 to 6 months.
Right.
And
it's
very balanced. And you can write down the formula, and then if the person is very deficient, very yin, losing energy, very chilly, cold, weak, debilitated, you can double up the builders. And if the person is very young or toxic or full or hot, you could double up the cleansers, you can just use the balanced formula. You can make that that choice.
Then the end of your book, you have a great section on the name of the plant, the scientific name, the temperature of the herbs, and its application, because, herbs have a temperature, and we like to balance patients out. So it's exciting to see that there's a nice kind of materia medica here at the end of the particular, one of your last form things there. And then you have a nice glossary, which I always like, because herbal medicine's confusing. There's all kinds of different, not only the names of the herbs, but what they do, and what's an antiphlogistic and what's an antispasmodic. A lot of patients don't know that, and your book is very excellent, which discusses these types of things there.
Well, I've been collecting this kind of stuff for for almost 30 years. I mean, that book, a lot of what I teach in my 6-month class that I teach every year, my intensive, a lot of it is what you see in the book. And I never done that before. In the past, I would always say, I'm going to do a Celtic herbal. I'm going to do an Irish herb book. I'm going to do an Irish tree book. I'm going to do a Scottish Highland medicine book, But this time I just said, I have this class. I'm teaching it. I'm not going to be around forever. I might as well start putting that down. And, in fact, Matthew Wood, do you know Matthew Wood?
Yeah, I know of him, sure, and Guido.
Yeah. Well, he was the one, he said, Ellen, you got to get this down before it's too late.
Well, that's always true,
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, Ellen. And thank you for your book, Secret Medicines from Your Garden, Plants for Healing, Spirituality, and Magic. I can't wait to get out there in the garden and get working.
Well, thank you, and happy spring to everybody who hears this.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always check us out at www.naturalnurse.com. Have a healthy day. Bye-bye.